It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. That's Paul McCartney taking the lead on the Beatles live version of Long Tall Sally. It was 50 years ago Sunday that the Beatles played their one and only Pittsburgh concert. It was at the now torn down Civic Arena on September 14th, 1964. And I'm joined now in studio by the men who made that concert happen, promoter Pat DeCesar, who is with us. Pat, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Paul. Nice to be here.
And legendary KQV disc jockey Chuck Brinkman. Chuck, honor to have you.
Thank you, Paul.
Good to have you with us here on Essential Pittsburgh. Chuck was the man who introduced the Beatles on stage at the Civic Arena, and we will hear that story. But, Pat, let's start with how you ended up bringing the Beatles to Pittsburgh, because let's face it, if it was not for you, we would not have had that concert. And this was something that was on your radar maybe before a lot of people had become aware of the Beatles. You pick up the story in the fall of 1963 when you were first hearing the Beatles music.
Well, my partner on the show was a person by the name of Tim Tormey, and Tim had a record distribution company. And our job was to promote records, get them played on radio, and get them stocked in stores. And when I heard the Beatles, I inquired from the person who introduced me to that, what play were they getting, or are they selling any records? And the answer was no. It was around the time that John Kennedy was killed, November of 63. They had released Love Me Do, P.S. I Love You, I Saw Her Standing There, She Loves You, all around February, March of 63.
And so you're hearing these songs. So first of all, and I think perhaps most importantly, what was it that you heard that turned you on, for lack of a better term, to the Beatles' sound?
Well, especially She Loves You, the yeah, yeah, yeah part. You know, I didn't realize that in England that was like a big deal, the yeah, yeah records. But in the United States, nobody thought English artists, especially rock artists, would ever be big. We kind of thought they were kind of corny. They didn't even have what we know as rock and roll at that time in the 61, 62, 63.
They were doing something that was kind of more
skiffle.
Folksy. Yeah, skiffle, exactly.
Right.
So, but you started making inquiries about maybe bringing them to Pittsburgh, right?
Well, I went to Tim. Tim was the promoter in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
He had done some things at the Syria Mosque, and the Civic Arena was just built in 1961. He was there with two shows before that. He was the concert promoter. And I mentioned this act to him, and not too many people who knew the Beatles until December 27th when they released, when Capitol released the album Meet the Beatles, and I Want to Hold Your Hand was the first song on the first side. And when that was played, then Capitol Records sold like a ton of 850,000 LPs in 10 days, which was unprecedented.
That's incredible. So then everybody's suddenly aware of the Beatles. They end up on Ed Sullivan. Now the coin has completely flipped, and you still want to bring them to Pittsburgh, but describe the conversation that ensues after Beatlemania really takes hold.
Well, Tim Tormey had managed Lou Christie, and Lou Christie was a Pittsburgh artist, but he'd gone national with Two Faces Have I, The Gypsy Cried, Lightning Strikes, you know. So he was represented by the William Morris Agency. The William Morris Agency in New York was the largest theatrical agency in the U.S., and Rosalind Ross was the agent, and Tim and I had discussed this possibility, and I said, why don't you ask Roz what it takes to do the Beatles, get the Beatles? And she said, well, forget it. No British artist would ever make it as a rock act in the U.S.
You know, so they were still skeptics.
Yeah, the Beatles won't come here. So we said, well, call your London office. And they said, yeah, the Beatles are big in England, but no British artist ever makes it in the U.S. as a rock artist, and just forget the Beatles and never come. But Brian Epstein wanted to really be sure that they would sell out. He didn't want to come here and be a fool, made a fool of. So when the Ed Sullivan Show played, 72 million people viewed that show. And that was the big thing. Brian thought, well, okay, they could do well in the United States. And like you say, everybody else, all the other promoters wanted them. All these cities wanted them. And Pittsburgh was just another city. But when they finally came around and says, okay, we'll consider you guys. But to get them, there's two things you might not like. One is the price. And at this time, when Tim Tormey would do a concert, a headliner might cost him $3,500 a night to play like the Siri Moscow.
$3,500 to book a big act.
A big act, headliner. Now the Beatles wanted $35,000.
10 times what a big act would normally charge.
Which meant the ticket price would have to be increased. At that time, the ticket prices were like 1.5, 2.5, 3.5.
So the Beatles would have had to have charged, I'll let you do the math.
Well, when we did the math, we thought, well, we got to charge $6.60. Then we thought, well, who would pay that much to see the Beatles?
Yeah, wow, $6.
So we reduced it to $5.90, thinking that sounds better, you know. Now, the second part of the thing that she said was, and
here's where it gets good.
Yeah. She says, and to prove to us that you guys can to do this and deliver, you have to put $5,000 cash in a brown paper bag and deliver it to a bartender at the Club Elegant in Brooklyn, New York. And you have 48 hours to do it.
Now, I think Peter Brown talks about this in his book, and so this is what you're describing has been documented. But for anybody hearing this for the first time, it sounds ridiculous. Why that process? Why $5,000 in a brown paper bag? Why the bar in Brooklyn? How did they even pick the bar?
Yeah, and to this day I still wonder. Okay,
I don't know.
I don't know who
50
got the
years
money
later.
What they did with the money or anything else. And in my partner, Tim, was kind of established. But the problem was the William Morris Agency did not get the act. It went to General Artists Corporation. And a guy by the name of Norman Weiss was the agent. And his brother, Ned Weiss, was the American attorney for the Beatles. And that's the tie-in.
So here you are. You really want to bring them, and so you're told about this process, and it's 48 hours to deliver the money, the cash?
Yes, because everybody in the country wanted them. There was a ballpark owner, you know, like in the Midwest. It might have been
Charlie Finley.
Right. And what did he offer them, like $165,000?
Well, I guess he wanted them for Kansas City, and they weren't originally on the list, so he had to come up with even more money. But as far as what you had to do, so here you are. It sounds crazy, but you've got to come up with the $5,000 cash in the brown paper bag in 48 hours. So what did you do, Pat?
Well, first of all, I didn't have $5,000. I mean, I'm a young kid. And
you're in your what? You're in your 20, early – how old were you?
I was 25 at the time, okay? And Tim was – he was an established business guy. I don't know to this day if he had $5,000 or didn't want to put it up or didn't have it. But my job was to go get the $5,000.
How did you do it?
I went to everybody I knew in business. If you were in the radio business, record store, I went to the Shapiro Brothers, National Record Mart, which we did a lot of business. They would not put up the $5,000. They thought we were crazy. I went to jukebox operators because I sold them a lot of records. And they had slot machines and poker machines. And I thought, well, sure, those guys would deliver. And they thought this was the biggest scam ever, that you would really have to be a fool to give a bartender in Brooklyn $5,000 cash.
So what happened?
Well, I lived in Trafford. I drove from Pittsburgh. It was like 20 miles to go home. And lived with my mom and dad. And that was a time when everybody sat around the kitchen table and ate together as a family, you know. So I was telling them the story that I'm telling you. But they didn't know who the Beatles were, anything about the Beatles. And they didn't say anything. Next day, I went back to Pittsburgh to go to work, tried to get the money again. I couldn't do any good with that. And when my day was done, I drove back home, sat at the kitchen table. My mother and dad put out the feast that we always had, and when we were done eating, my dad slid an envelope across the table towards me. And I said, "What's that?" And he says, "That's for you." And I opened the envelope, and there's a check made out to me for $5,000. Now, I tell you something about my dad. He came from Italy when he was 17, right? Worked in a coal mine. Then he got a job at Westinghouse Electric. Had two jobs. Never made close to anywhere near $100 a week. When we grew up in a two-bedroom house. My five brothers and I was the youngest, lived in the attic. We didn't even have heat. We didn't have hot water until I was about 10. Okay, but my dad made things happen. The greatest thing that happened to me was my dad believed in me. So I said, "Dad, this is $5,000. Where'd you get it?" He said, "At the Westinghouse Credit Union, I put the house up as security for the loan." I said, "Dad, I can't take your $5,000. I mean, I have to give this to a bartender in Brooklyn. I mean, I don't even know if this is for real." And he said, "Do you believe in the Beatles?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, then you go ahead and take the money and go do your Beatles."
And the Beatles ended up coming to Pittsburgh September 14th, 1964. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' one and only appearance in Pittsburgh with promoter Pat DeCesar and legendary KQB disc jockey Chuck Brinkman.
That does sound like a story out of Goodfellas, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? It really does.
Bartender in Brooklyn and all that, yeah.
And there's more to it. Get to that in a moment. But Chuck had the incredible good fortune. I think anybody who's ever worked in radio is extremely jealous of you then and now. You got to introduce the Beatles on stage at the Civic Arena.
Right.
What was that like?
And the greatest experience of my life up till now. I mean, you know, I reflect on that as the greatest moment in my radio career. I mean, I just can still recreate it in my head the night that it happened, September 14th.
So there was a lot leading up to this, and there was kind of a radio war going on.
Oh, yeah,
it's very interesting to read about. KDKA was the established, you know, big station, big name entity in radio in Pittsburgh, and
we weren't far behind.
Yeah, well, there's a lingering argument about that, but that's a story for another day. KQV,
right,
though, was kind of the feisty kid challenging, mm-hmm, the big time ratings leader KDKA with this new rock and roll format, which the Beatles became an integral part of.
Definitely.
And you wanted to establish yourselves as the Beatles station.
Right.
So what did you do?
Well, I took my program director over to meet Tim. He was really reluctant. He said, "He can come to me." I said, no, we go to him. So I took him over there and explained everything. I said, "This is the biggest act that's ever come to Pittsburgh or anywhere. It's the tour that starts in 64. So they made a deal on the side. Tim said, "I'll tell you what, if you get the Beatles, I want all of our future shows to be KQV Shower of Stars." And, you know, he had a big list of things that he wanted to do, other shows down the road. So they made the deal, and that was how it all happened.
I'm guessing anything he said you were pretty much going to agree to?
Yes. Well, it wasn't me. It was my program director.
Right.
Who was again, reluctant to meet Tim. I had to literally force him to go over to his office in the Carlton House.
So you have this deal, but KDKA tries to undermine you.
Always.
They had a hot shot, a well-regarded radio personality himself, a fellow named Clark Race.
Mm-hmm.
And Clark decided he's going to get on the Beatles plane coming from Baltimore the night before.
It was the Westinghouse correspondent had a seat on that plane. And KDK was a Westinghouse station at the time. So Clark figured he could, you know, work his way into that situation. But my boss called me on Sunday night and he said, or on Saturday night, he said, "I want you guys on that plane to Baltimore tomorrow. Dex Allen, our night disc jockey, and me," and he said, "Whatever you do, I don't want to see Clark Race on that Beatle plane. I don't care what you do." And that was a challenge.
It sounds like it might have almost come to blows.
It came very close. Well, Clark felt very entitled because of he had a TV show every day, and of course he had an afternoon radio show. We were directly in competition with one another. We were the full-time top 40 station. They were not. They did not do the formatic top 40. They did KDKA radio, MOR, middle of the road, but, you know, personality oriented.
You felt like you were the rock jocks. This was
We were it. We
right.
were, you know, we were the top 40 station. He was the also-ran. And that was our frame of mind. And we can stop him.
And I read it. He literally got pulled off that Brian Epstein had to go to him and say, I'm sorry.
Not Brian Epstein. It was Bess Coleman. Bess Coleman was Brian Epstein's secretary. My friend knew somebody that knew him, knew her. So we managed to get up to her room at the Holiday Inn in Baltimore. And we came just like I'm coming to you saying, hey, we don't care what. We don't want Clark Race on that plane. This is our show tomorrow night, not his. And so she immediately said, don't worry about it. She called the Westinghouse correspondent. She said, whatever thoughts you had, they can't happen. No Clark Race on any Beatle plane. So he went on KDK and said, well, I'm having no problem with the Beatles in Baltimore. I'm having problems with my two friends from KQV.
And the war was on.
It was on.
But KQV was the presenting station.
We were.
And you were the man on stage who got to introduce the Beatles. So describe it, what that was like. Are Paul and John and Ringo and George literally waiting in the wings, waiting on your words?
No, they were, it was funny, backstage they were tuning up. And we had seen them the night before in Baltimore. We got a little familiar with their personalities. And, I mean, we weren't, you know, hanging together, but we talked to them a little bit. So they knew who we were. And, no, they were, you know, they just came out, and then I came out. All of the disc jockeys from KQV came out, but I was the one selected. I was the 7 to midnight guy, so I had the teenage crowd. So I was the guy selected to introduce them.
And what also happened during the course? From what I understand, they didn't play for very long. And
I think 28 minutes.
28 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And what did it sound like?
Noisy.
Could you hear them?
No. Fourth row. First to fourth row, you could hear them, but beyond the fourth row, nothing. The amps were weak. The PA system was weak. I mean, you know, it just wasn't there.
Well, nobody – I guess the Beatles
nobody
were really
cared.
Ahead of their time because
– Nobody cared. They saw them visually. They heard them. They didn't hear them literally, but they could hear them singing or watch them singing, and that was all most everybody in that crowd needed.
And what was the rest of your interaction like with them?
Well, post or that night?
Post or that night.
Well – it's a quick story. Post in 1965, that same program director said to me, we're going to the Bahamas. I said, oh, yeah. And back then you had to have credentials. You just couldn't go somewhere the Beatles were. So we get on a plane. We go to the Bahamas. And we stayed in the same hotel Brian Epstein was in. It was a very posh resort. We get downstairs. There are the four of them hanging on the beach, goofing, you know. I said, let's go get them. He said, nope, nope. I said, I was close, you know, 5 feet away. Nope. Don't talk to them. So we went over and met the producer of the movie, which was at the time Help.
They were filming it in the Bahamas.
He introduced my boss, John Rook, said, hey, look, we have no credentials. We came down here on a whim. We'd love to talk to the guys. We work at ABC. He threw that out because we WLS Chicago, WABC New York, WXYZ New York, or Detroit. That was a pretty good lineup. Said, okay. So he delivered Paradise Island. The next morning, all four of them, to me, one-on-one. That had never happened. You had a press conference. You stood behind five other guys, and they answered stupid questions.
You had a one-on-one interview.
But it was a good question. They weren't showing off for anybody. That was the point. You know, they were just being themselves, not acting.
And Pat DeCesar, as it turns out, we've got just a minute or so left, but you did not get to go to the Beatle concert in Pittsburgh.
That's correct.
What happened? You were in the Army at that time?
Yeah, well, we booked a show in February for September, and on May 29th, I got drafted and went into the Army. So on September 14th, I was more concerned about figuring out how to stay alive, I think. I was in Fort Sill, Oklahoma then, still in training.
But I'm guessing, in spite of that, that the thought must have crossed your mind about, I wonder how it's going up in Pittsburgh, and boy, do I wish I was there.
You know, I wish I could say that. I was so wrapped up in the Army, I didn't think about anything else. I really didn't. I just thought about getting through the day.
Getting out of the Army.
Have you thought about it? Did you think about it since, though?
Well, I never realized or thought that it would be this big. I just thought, like, okay, that's
just another
good
concert.
Act. Yeah.
Sure. And the Beatles were had a way, as Chuck just described, of expressing their gratitude, remembering those who helped them make it in those early days. Was there ever an expression of gratitude?
Well, you know, they broke up after a while, and they sort of went their separate ways. And then we booked Paul McCartney independently, Ringo, George, but John never did. We never played John.
But you did have a future relationship with him, which is
we played all of their dates.
Well, Pat DeCesar, the man, the promoter who brought the Beatles to Pittsburgh, and the legendary KQV disc jockey Chuck Brinkman. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here and sharing this fascinating story.
We'd love to tell it.
50 years ago Sunday, the Beatles performed in Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everyone.